Anybody who has ever worked as a youth minister or youth ministry volunteer owes a debt of gratitude to Wayne Rice. One of the co-founders of Youth Specialties, Wayne has worked to equip and resource youth workers for almost 50 years. Over the course of that time, he's experienced a lot, rethought how we do youth ministry, and is now working to resource grandparents in their efforts to lead their grandchildren to Jesus. We're thrilled to be chatting with our friend and hero, Wayne Rice, about youth ministry, grandparenting, and a whole lot more on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, welcome everybody to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm, as always, Walt Mueller here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding with Jason Soschenik coming to us live from Spokane, Washington, the world headquarters of Project 619. Are you in your house?
I am in my house, yeah, but I like the way that you set it up as if we have a headquarters. It's kind of like if I was a part of the Justice League or something.
Yeah, well, people never know.
Own headquarters.
Yeah, call you and you answer the phone and they're going, what are you doing answering the phone? I thought you'd have, you know, five hoops to jump through of people to get to you, and they don't realize. It's the same thing here at CPYU.
Yeah.
It's like
in the White House when they used to have the red telephone, right? And so it's a direct line Russia. Well, we have a direct line to CPYU and Project 619.
And
to answer your questions, to
help out as we might. Well, what I'm saying is when we say world headquarters, don't imagine a skyscraper. Right? Imagine a house.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's kind of the way that it is.
You've got a little bit more retail space than we. We have an office and then a cubicle. So it's a nice size office, but the world headquarters is more like a world box.
Yeah.
We get to share with four of us.
Well, as long as we work hard and we're doing good work, that's all that matters, right?
Amen.
Okay. Well, listen, we are multinational organizations. I'm pretty excited about the podcast today. We're going to get to chat with my old friend Wayne Rice. And when I say old, I mean he's been a friend for a while, one of the co-founders of Youth Specialties, which actually didn't start in a box. It started in the trunk of a car.
So I know, amazing. Well, I mean, it's kind of like a superhero. We kind of got like the superhero of the youth worker world that's coming on, so that will be a lot of fun.
Yeah, so we're going to have a chat with Wayne a little bit later. Before that, we want to talk about youth culture, some of the things that are happening. And we always take the dangerous step of opening the microphones to Kenton and Chris, they control everything here anyway, so it doesn't matter. They can open the microphones whenever they want, but we actually have opportunities for them to quiz us or question us or spark some conversation.
What do you got? So we got a question today. We need to get a quiz again. But the question is, if you could only eat at one restaurant for the rest of your life, what would it be?
The question, restaurant. Real quick, can it be a local restaurant that no one would know, or does it have to be a chain that we
for sure
are familiar? Okay, so it could be either a local or it could be a national. Okay, Walt?
Why are you deferring to me so quickly? You don't have an answer and you're just putting it on me, huh?
Well, kind
of. Or maybe it's because of our age.
I actually think that you might be able to respond much more quickly.
If things go as they're going already, the rest of my life is actually shorter than the rest of yours. So you want me to get this in before my life comes to an end, right? Is that how this is working?
I was not thinking in the restaurant terms, you choose
could shorten or prolong
rather interesting that you say that, because I'm trying to choose strategically because I have these conversations with Lisa from time to time about the food I digest and what is healthy and what is not.
That, yeah. Yeah, you've mentioned that quite a few times.
But you can all, now these are all our meals. We're taking all our meals for the rest of our lives at this restaurant. Or we go out once a month, and this is, I know I'm getting technical here, but.
Every meal for the rest of your life.
Okay, all right. That's good to clarify that. Because my go-to for that would be the same answer I would have as if I was on a desert island and I could only have one food item for the rest of my life. It would be pizza. Because I think that would be the thing that I would get tired of. The novelty of it wouldn't wear off so quick. I wouldn't get tired of it as quickly as I would with other foods. Now, the restaurant.
So Domino's.
No. No, I don't think so. I mean, I was tempted to say Pizza Hut just because pizza's in the name. And most people know what Pizza Hut is, but I don't think I've eaten at a Pizza Hut for years. So I guess I'll choose a local joint. Is that okay? Well, you said that was okay.
Yeah, that's all.
So
that's all right.
You know, Di Maria's down in Mount Joy. They make some good pizza. So I would say, you've eaten at Di Maria's, Chris?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah, they have good pizza. Those guys do the New York style. It's not Lancaster County style. So I like that.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, Di Maria's pizza. Give me pizza for the rest of my life.
Wow.
Jason, you're going to go to Salad Works or something like that, aren't you?
Well, you know, I actually was going to say, I would have thought that because of the number of choices that you have and if it's the only place that you can eat, I would have thought you would have said like Shady Oaks or Shady Maples where you are having your upcoming fundraiser.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if anyone else knows this.
Why are we laughing at him
this.
Right now? We can't get the name right.
Yeah, that's why.
Shady Oaks. What?
I think that's like a retirement
center. What is it?
Yeah, Shady Maple. Oaks is a kind. Shady Maple. It's not Shady
Maple. Shady Maple. Yeah. Shady Maple. Well, yeah. Oak, Maple. Yeah. It's close. Whatever. Well, Shady Maple, right?
No.
And so anyone that's listening to this podcast right now, take a pause, go and check out Shady Maple, and you will see this buffet that goes on for an eternity. I mean, it has more food choices than you could ever dream up. Honestly, it will take you 3 minutes to walk from one end of the buffet to the other end of the buffet. And that 3 minutes of walking for food is
without
a long
traffic.
Time.
You know, I asked.
Without
I asked
traffic.
Him,
no, there is traffic in this place.
We have our banquet there on a Friday night in the banquet center. And it's separate from everything else, you know, separate entrance. It's very classy, very nice. But I walked over a couple of years ago to the buffet on a Friday night, and you know they basically have like turnstiles. It's like TSA lanes that you go through to get into this place, and all kinds of rules about, you know, you can't take food out and that sort of thing. But I asked them about the Saturday morning breakfast, and they told me, yes, tomorrow we will serve, and they gave me a number. Do you want to guess how many people they were planning on serving the next day? This
oh,
was and this
5,
is an 000? Average. No, you're low. This is an average on a Saturday. No, you're high.
And are you talking just for breakfast?
Just for breakfast on a Saturday morning.
Oh, just for breakfast.
Yeah.
Saturday morning.
Yeah.
How many?
10,000. They will have 10,000 people come through there to eat breakfast. And it's amazing here in Lancaster, you see these license plates from New York, Virginia, Maryland, New Jersey. Who knows where else? Buses come in. I mean, it's. Yeah. I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Wow.
What's your?
I just feel like I'm putting on the pounds talking about it.
Yeah, well, I think that actually happens. You, Jason, do you have a place?
Gosh, I wouldn't choose. You chose like one food item. I'm not going to choose
one
food item.
That's probably smart.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to choose a location where all of the food is good. And to save our listeners from any sort of local choice, I would say
right,
nationally.
Right, so you're criticizing me twice now.
No. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying.
You're criticizing my choice.
There are a lot more listeners that know about your area than they do about Spokane, Washington. So I just think that I want to honor the fact that there are not many people that know much about Spokane that are listening to us. So with that, I'm going to say a food chain or a restaurant that might make some cringe, but Applebee's. I think Applebee's has done a great job over the last few years of reshaping its menu. Its menu as it stands has a lot of really good choices. I don't think I'd, over time, I'd get really sick of it, but I think that I could live off of it for a little while. There's salads, there's burgers, there's good healthy sandwiches. So I'm going to say Applebee's.
That's a good choice. If you guys asked a question again, I might come up with something else. Chris, do you have got a place?
I'm torn between choosing a Mexican restaurant and a Chinese restaurant that I have in mind because there would be, you know, you get plenty of variety with the two, I think. I will choose, there's a restaurant in Cranberry Township, Pennsylvania, that I grew up going to frequently called House of Chen. It was a Chinese restaurant. Since I moved away, they remodeled it, they redid it, they've changed the menu. So it's not the same restaurant as that I recall. So my choice would be, you know, House of Chen 20 years ago rather than what it looks like today. But a Chinese restaurant, House of Chen.
That's admirable.
There's lots of choices.
That's admirable.
They have the best General Tso's I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I also think they had the best lo mein that I've ever had. So lots of good choices.
Were we supposed to get into actually reciting the menu here?
I don't know. You and Chris have gone,
that wasn't part of the
question. Straight to like the highlight.
It was now 20 years ago, but I remember the menu well.
I can't wait to hear what Kenton says. He's got this goofy grin on his face. Well, that's there all the time, right?
That's true.
Yeah, what?
I mean, for me, Jason stole mine early, but I was going to go Shady Maple for the wide variety, and plus I don't have to eat it all as much as possible all the time. But Applebee's is a very good choice because you can get a decent steak if you want, or you can spread it out to sliders, mozzarella sticks, whatever. So I'm kind of torn between the two. I'm going to go Shady Maple because he already took Applebee's.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Well, maybe we'll get some podcast sponsors out of this. That'd be nice, huh?
That would be excellent.
Yeah. Well, now that we've...
This portion of the podcast brought to you by Applebee's.
Now that we've talked about food, let's talk about youth culture, our little two-minute drill. And, Jason, we're going to start with you. What trends are you uncovering, reading about, hearing about, studying? What are the things we need to make people aware of?
Most definitely. I'll start with just an app that I recently came across called Yellow. Have you heard about this app, Walt?
Yes, I have, but tell us more.
Yeah. Well.
If I had said yes, would we have moved on to the next trend?
Well, we know. Okay, I still would have let you know because there are listeners that don't know what it is.
Yes, tell us more.
But I actually just came across this just recently, and I've actually had a lot of conversation with students that have been using this and then youth workers that have been trying to figure out what to do. Yellow, for those of you that don't know, is an app that was developed for ages 13 and up. It's as it's described, it's kind of like the Tinder of friendships. So just like when you go onto Tinder and you can swipe left, swipe right based upon attraction, this is really meant to be an app for adolescents 13 and up to be able to find friends. And so I don't know how you find friends based upon attraction. That's not how I went about doing it, but it's really just an image that you see and you'd swipe left. Hey, that looks like a cool person, or swipe right, depending on who it is that you who it is you see and what you like about their profile. You can either like or not like. And this app, though, as you can probably guess, has a lot of issues that can come up. Now, there are some barriers to protection. They do say that they separate those that are 18 and under from those that are 18 and up. However, as we both know, you can lie about your age on an app like this. And so there's still a lot of danger when it comes to this app. And that's why we want to share it, because we want for parents, we want for youth workers to know what it's about. We recommend just even checking out what the app is about, because there are probably youth that are in your youth ministry, or you might have a son or daughter that is using this, so that you can become aware. According to the website for the app, it's created to help children who have trouble making friends. And I think the idea is admirable, but we just have to be aware of what this type of software, these apps, can actually provide, which is a gateway for individuals that might want to do something other than just build friendships.
Those are the kinds of kids that predators cultivate. you know, go after and groom. So we really need to be careful about that. Kids who are especially vulnerable to that would be drawn to something like this. Well, let me talk about one of the dangers associated with e-cigarettes. Maybe you've seen this. Maybe you've heard this in the last month, month and a half. There's been a lot of talk about a new practice for that people who are involved with e-cigarettes are indulging in. It's called dripping. So you have these electronic cigarettes, which have these battery-operated heating coils that are called atomizers. They turn liquids, often flavored, sometimes with nicotine in them. It turns them into vapor, and then you smoke this. You've seen people doing vaping. Well, the journal Pediatrics, and remember what Pediatrics is about. It's about medical issues with kids, children. The journal Pediatrics is now warning physicians to warn parents about the number of kids who are doing what's called dripping. So what they do with this is they manually drop the highly concentrated juice, which is flavored and sometimes contains nicotine. Rather than allowing it to dissipate, they drop it directly onto this electronic coil, and then the resulting vapor is inhaled. And what this does, this dripping does, is it intensifies the amount of the liquid that goes into a person's body, whether it's into their throat or into their lungs. It can expose them to unsafe levels of what are called e-liquids. And so they do this because it says, you know, well, they say, well, it makes the flavors taste better because it's more robust. They get thicker clouds of vapor. They get a stronger hit in their throat. Some of them just do it out of curiosity. Fact of the matter is, any kind of smoking is dangerous. The jury is still out. A lot of research is being done on e-cigarettes. There's no reason to believe that they're safe and harmless, as many would say that they are. And especially when you get involved with liquids that are contain nicotine and with this dripping, I'm sure there's going to be health issues that come from it. So, again, parents, another issue to warn your kids about.
Well, when thinking about conversations around sex education, we do a lot of work, Project 619, in the classroom. And what we've seen a lot of educators and even counselors start to ask questions about is, do we bring up the topic of love? So much of sex ed really deals with the biology, the body, the anatomy, the function. But there is a growing trend, and we've known this for quite a long time, and that's why within the work that we do with our Life Up Close presentation, we actually go far beyond just the idea of sex and actually go into the personhood of an individual, how they live, life mapping, and media discernment. These are all things that are actually really important as they're trying to make a decision about when and where they're going to engage in sex. And one of those topics is love. And love is such a needed topic for teens to be able to discuss. And, you know, in the well over a decade it's been since I started teaching in the schools, I've seen the need to have really good conversations around love and healthy relationships. And the question that I sometimes get from educators and even counselors is this a place that we need to be doing it? And my simple answer is yes, we need to be having these conversations. We need to have good sex education that's not just dealing with the anatomy. Those are great things, but sex ed, good sex ed, deals not just with the physical, but mind, body, soul, spirit, emotional, social, financial. And if you're in the church, when you're having your sex talks, they need to go far beyond the physical. We see this in scripture. And so love should be a part of this dynamic and a part of this conversation. And that's why when we're diving into these topics, we've got to be able to find conversations that point to what is good ways to love, and separate that from bad ways, or really look at God's way of loving others, if you're in the church, and the ways in which Hollywood might promote love. Separating those two can be really beneficial, I think, for youth, especially as they're starting to navigate the questions and the world in which they live when it comes to sex and sexuality.
Hey, one of the ways to do that is to have kids deconstruct in the media bad definitions of love, point them out and get them to be able to identify those. Jason, I want to talk about teenagers and driving. We've talked about this before, and one of the things that we say here at CPYU all the time is that we need to teach our kids that driving, like everything else in life, is something that needs to be done under the lordship of Jesus Christ. Because we're followers of Jesus, we drive, yet we drive in different ways. Our faith should inform our driving. We drive as an act of worship. AAA, the American Automobile Association, has come out with a study that's identified the top three deadly teenage driving mistakes, and this serves as a warning. And you may not find this surprising at all, but here they are in order. Number one is speeding. You know, we know that kids will take risks. You get the chance to drive, and you're going to test and see how fast the car can go. The second mistake, deadly mistake, is distractions. So this would be more than one person in the car. When you have someone else in the car with you, that creates distractions. Turning the radio up loud is an issue. And, of course, cell phones as well, texting or trying to engage with the phone while you're driving. And then the third deadly habit, teenage driving mistake, is poor visual scanning. That's the way 3A's describes it, poor visual scanning. And this is running our eyes across the entire road, scanning it for risks and hazards, you know, to see if something's in the road. And when we get tunnel vision, we tend not to pay attention to what's happening on the road, and that can actually be deadly. We run into something, hit something, and, you know, have problems because we're not recognizing the hazards. All that to say, parents, be aware, youth workers, be aware that we need to teach our kids to drive to the glory of God, and part of that is to help them see what the mistakes are that others have made that are incredibly costly, especially in terms of lives. And point your kids to driving to the glory of God.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up the AAA study, because my next topic really has to deal exactly with that, with regards to tools that parents can use when they have a teen driver. And I came across six types of technology, and I'll go through a few of them, highlight a few of them real quickly here. But there is technology, I should say, available for teen drivers, especially as a parent. And there are those that are in the vehicle, and then there are also those that are apps. But with the world in which teens live, and even for us, there are a number of distractions, as the report you just mentioned point out. And the reality is, it's not just teen drivers anymore. It's all drivers that are highly distracted because of the smartphone, because of the things that we get, texts, emails. We're highly distracted. And so it leads to some of these other causes, I think. And so having technology that actually limits our use of technology can be really good. In the vehicle, there are a couple of different gadgets. One is OnStar Family Link. It's something that you can get if you have an OnStar plan or an OnStar tool inside your car. Only certain cars have that. And if they don't, there are also a couple of other ways. There's a thing called Moto Safety, and then Groove, which honestly was one of my favorites as I was doing some research around this. It's fairly cost effective, and it's really one that helps deal with the content that's happening in the car, and also prevent all incoming texts, calls, and notifications while the teen is driving. I know this doesn't necessarily work for everyone. I know that there are other ways that you can limit this, pulling over, etc. But this tended to be the least expensive, and I was at $5 or $10 a month. But one of the things I found was EverDrive. It's an app, and it's a participation tool that both parents and teens could actually do, and it almost creates this game between who is driving least distracted, and it rewards you based upon who is deciding to stop text from coming in, who is not engaging in any sort of phone messages as things are happening while you're on the road. And so it's a free app. It's something that both teens and adults can use. But there are also some other apps, which real quickly, AT&T, Verizon has some, and then also one called Cell Control. Each of those costs money. And I just think being aware of some of the technology that allows for us to be able to drive safely can be really good, both for teens, but also for parents.
Yeah. All right. I want to end this this segment about youth culture by talking a little bit about the rate of cultural change, how it's happening at faster and faster rates. I think the best way for me to do this is to put Kenton on the spot. Oh, look at that. He had a glass of water right up to his mouth. So, Kenton, if I say to you, if I give you the initials TRL, what does that stand for?
Oh, man, I don't like being on the spot.
Do you know right off the top of your head if I say TRL, he's thinking? No?
I don't think so.
Okay, all right. Well, that's all right, because you're in good company, which is everybody else from your generation, because, you know, the React YouTube channel, which they make these videos of people watching things and reacting to them in real time. It's quite entertaining. They asked a bunch of teenagers to identify various MTV television shows from just beyond the year 2000. Okay, now you know, don't you?
Yeah, because I watched this video like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, you did watch it. Okay, so you got to see this, so you know how it works. So TRL stands for, do you remember now? Oh, he still can't remember. Chris, do you remember?
Total Request Live.
That's it. Total Request
yes.
Live.
Who was
with Carson
the, and
Daly
who was the host?
I just said it. Carson Daly.
Oh, Carson Daly.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah. Now he's on. What is he on? The Today Show.
The Voice.
The Voice. Yeah. So he's on a variety. He's an old guy now, right? So Carson Daly used to host that. You know, TRL Total Request Live. Kids didn't know what that show was, nor did they know what most of the other TV shows were that were on MTV during that time. In fact, one person said MTV had television shows. You know, so again, you just begin to see just the things that were part of our childhood growing up or even our adulthood as parents that were part of our kids' world. Stuff is happening at such an increased rate of speed, and the change is happening exponentially. It's just happening so fast that it's easy to fall out of touch with what's happening in youth culture. So if we're out of touch, we can't respond biblically. And so, again, just to show you that things are happening fast, parents, your responsibility, your youth workers, your responsibility now is to stay in touch. So work to understand what your kids are listening to, what they're reading, what they're watching, and look for opportunities to converse with them in ways that will teach them to think critically and Christianly about all of these things. Know where your kids are spending time and what's shaping them. Well, that said, we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to have a great conversation with our friend Wayne Rice. Stick with us. Are you interested in bringing CPYU to your church, school, or community? A big part of our ministry is the on-site seminars we conduct in dozens of settings every year. CPYU seminars are designed to encourage and educate your audience on a variety of youth culture issues. Every seminar is designed to be informative, practical, and hope-filled. If you want to learn more about our CPYU seminars, available speakers, and the many seminar topics and options in our growing seminar lineup, go to our CPYU homepage at cpyu.org. Click on the seminar option on the menu bar at the top of the page, and you can learn more about how to schedule a CPYU speaker and seminar for your parents, youth workers, and educators. Well, welcome back, everybody, to Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller with Jason Soshenick, as always. And I am very excited today to talk to a friend who, long before he was a friend, he was a mentor from afar and has remained a mentor because of his involvement in serving the church and serving God's kingdom as someone in youth ministry and then transitioning into doing family ministry, which we'll hear more about. And now, working with grandparents, of which I am one, so I'm passionate about that as well, want to hear about that. But Wayne Rice, who most of our folks would know as one of the co-founders of Youth Specialties, an organization that's been going for, how long, Wayne? When did you guys start that?
Oh, man, we started Youth Specialties in 1968.
Okay.
So
I was in middle school. And
almost 50 years.
Yeah, and I was reaping the benefits of the, and we'll talk more about that, the things you guys were doing in my youth group experience, including getting shocked from time to time. you knew that'd come up, right? Somehow that always comes into the sense. Yeah, but
Do you want my apology now? Or
No. I had fun with that as a youth pastor too, but we won't talk about that. But anyway.
Wait. Getting shocked?
You can't just say
getting shocked leave it.
I'll preface anything Wayne says by saying back in the early days of youth group, well, you know, Jason, you have a Young Life background. So with skits and things like that, there were a lot of crazy things we did to each other. And that when we then became youth pastors, we did to students that probably now we'd never even think of doing. So what used to be a joke, now we bring it up. I shouldn't have brought it up. We start talking about that.
It's funny, Walt. Over the weekend, I was having a conversation with somebody about who actually invented, you know, the hot seat, you know, which is this electric chair. What we would do is take a Model T coil from an old Model T Ford, and you could wire it up to a 9-volt battery, and you could shock, you know, if somebody sat down on this. We rigged it up so you could shock kids, and they just come flying off the chair, you know, these wires that we put across the top of the chair, then cover them, kind of hide them under a little cloth, you know, like some kind of covering just to disguise it. But we'd have all kinds of fun with that at a club until later on when we'd get sued, you know, for that. But back in the day of early youth ministry and campus life clubs and all of that, that kind of stuff went over really big with the kids. You know, it was considered a practical joke. But it's funny, we were just trying to figure out who actually invented that thing, and we traced it to a guy who just recently passed away, who was like the first youth guy in San Diego back in the early, late 50s, early 60s. So his name was Vaughn, Pastor Vaughn.
So you had not heard of that, Jason.
See, I've never, no. I was in youth ministry in the 90s and then early 2000s. And when by that point you were too scared of getting sued or having a parent get so upset that
it
you
was
get
a
fired.
Felony
so,
by then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the closest thing I had to getting shocked was putting a dog collar on and running over the electrical fence to see what kind of a shock you got. But that was with friends. That was not in a youth ministry. So this is exciting to hear.
Oh, we used to do all kinds of terrible things to teenagers back in the 60s. All in the name of good fun and the gospel. So,
yeah,
there
yeah.
You go.
I love it.
Yeah, Kenton here is a recent student ministry graduate from Lancaster Bible College. Last June, he lit up when you started to talk about this. So I got a hunch he's going to be tracking this down and building one of these things. He's kind of handy and he likes to tinker. So. But so let's go back and let's start a little bit of the story. But you and Mike Iaconelli and how this whole thing got started and what, at that point in time, you guys were trying to do for youth ministry and the youth ministry community. Talk a little bit about the history of that.
Well, you know, after youth culture really got started, and you're the expert on youth culture, but it really wasn't until the 40s and 50s that you know, youth culture really went into full blossom. And there were some organizations that had sprung up to minister to the kids who were part of that, all the teenagers. And those were organizations like Youth for Christ and Young Life. And there were a few others, Christian Endeavor, some of those. They were parachurch ministries. And Mike Iaconelli and I were both, we both came up through Youth for Christ. And so our churches didn't have youth groups. They would send all the kids to Youth for Christ, the rallies on Saturday night, or the Bible clubs, which were YFC clubs. They became campus life clubs. But mid-60s, Mike and I left Youth for Christ, and both of us went into churches as part-time youth pastors. Now, in San Diego, I mentioned Pastor Vaughn. He was really one of the first paid youth guys in San Diego, if not the first. And there were very few others. And so Mike went into a Baptist church. I was in a Nazarene church. And we were both working with kids but had no resources. And we remembered, you know, in Youth for Christ, there were resources because there was kind of a network of among Youth for Christ directors of stuff to do, you know, at your club meetings and how to connect with kids, what to do, you know, how to lead Bible discussions, that sort of thing, in a kind of cool way. But there was nothing like that for people in the church. So we thought, why don't we start an organization to share ideas among youth workers who were starting to be hired by churches? And this was kind of a new thing back in the 60s. And so we took a lot of our best ideas, put them into a book, called it Ideas. And we had no intention of there being an Ideas number two. But we put that first idea book out in 1968. And that really kind of we needed to put something other than Mike and Wayne's publishing company on the book. So we came up with a name, Youth Specialties, because there was a place down the street called Corvette Specialties where they sold Corvette parts. And so we instantly said, that sounds good. Just type it in there. So it took us about 5 minutes. Now, you know, if you were to come up with the name of a new ministry, you'd probably had to do focus groups and take, you know, months to come up with this thing. But it was about a 3-minute decision based on Mike had this fondness for Corvettes. And so youth specialties instead of Corvette specialties. So that's kind of how it all started. And then ideas number two came out because people started sharing their ideas with us. And then about a year later, we did the first National Youth Workers Convention. We were kind of brazen in calling it that. Everybody thought, you know, come on, you know, the National Youth Workers Convention. And so we did in 1970 was the first one. And we had about 300 youth workers. We thought we had every single youth guy in the whole country there. And by the way, you notice I said youth guy. Literally, that's the way it was back in those days. Usually there were very few women involved. But that's kind of how it started. You know, we really had no intention of it ever becoming a big, you know, like it became over the years. But we ended up, one thing led to another, and we just sort of followed God's leading in that and eventually gave up our jobs at the church so that we could run youth specialties full time in the 70s.
And just speaking so many good things into the lives of people like me. I mean, I think about secondhand in the sense that my youth workers when I was in middle school and high school were tapping into these things early on. And then I get out of youth group, I go to college, graduate, become a youth pastor. And the way that you guys resourced us when no one else was doing that in that way, it was amazing. I'll just say this, Jason, one of the highlights of the last few years in terms of youth ministry for me was Wayne and I don't know if you remember this, Wayne, but we were down at Southern Seminary speaking at something together for Troy Temple and some others there. And at one point you brought out of your bag the original ideas book, which was like made on a mimeograph machine and spiral bound or something. I mean, it was, and for me to be able to hold that, it was like going into the National Archives and being able to hold touch the Declaration of Independence or the concept. I mean, it was so fun to see that and take a picture with it just because of the history of that. How many ideas books eventually came to be? How many were there? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, when we got up to around volume 56 or 7 or something like that, we decided to stop putting them out as books, you know, and so they became more, you know, available in digital formats and that sort of thing. But that really was kind of what got us started, was just sharing ideas, you know. And our claim to fame was these were not ideas written by some retired minister up in an ivory tower somewhere. These were ideas that had been actually created out in the field by youth workers. And so they were tried and true, tried and tested ideas. And so that didn't always mean they were appropriate or useful in other ways, but there's a lot of
shock the system.
Yeah, but there's a lot of stuff. You know, you go back and look at those first idea books, they're pretty embarrassing, you know, about what passed as good ideas back in those days. But that's where we were.
Yeah, cutting edge at the time.
Yeah. And go ahead. Sorry, Wayne.
No, go. I'll take your question. What was that?
Well, no, I'm curious what it was like when you first started the conferences, because what so many youth workers have come to know Youth Specialties as today is a place to be resourced. It's a conference. There's other books, but I'm curious what it was when you first started, because you and Mike just had this vision and you went with it, and what it was like in the very first stages. Because I'm always interested to hear what it was like when it first began to where it is today.
Yeah, I think when we first began, it really was more of a an idea sharing kind of just it was kind of the idea books in a conference. And so a lot of the first year especially, we had a lot of people who were involved in youth ministry on some level as general session speakers and breakout leaders. And it wasn't until it happened pretty quickly, but about I think it was in 71 was really the first year that we thought, you know, let's make the convention a little bit more of a growing edge for youth workers, you know, spiritually, and help them to get out, think outside the lines a little bit more. By that time, we had started a magazine called the Wittenberg Door, and it was kind of a satirical magazine to inspire change. You know, today I think, you know, I get the, you know, the Babylon Bee.
Oh yeah, that's the Kinect. I tell people that all the time.
And it reminds me a lot of us in the early days. We were just, you know, these smart-ass youth workers out in California who were just trying to make fun of everything. And so the 71 convention, we went after some people that we thought could just push us a little bit. And among them was Francis Schaefer, who was one of our heroes as a writer. And when we first contacted him, he said he couldn't do it, you know, because first of all, who were we? But second of all, he was in Switzerland, and he wasn't planning to come to the U.S. that year. So Iaconelli, he just didn't take no for an answer. He just jumped on a plane, went to Switzerland, and told him, "You've got to come." Yeah. And so he said yes. And so it was the only trip Schaefer made to the U.S. that whole year. And he spoke at our convention. And that really kind of helped put us on the map a little bit, you know, because we got some good press. And,
yeah.
And God was really part of that. You know, I look back and I just think it's just amazing how the Lord used a couple of you know, guys who neither one of us knew much about business. We didn't know much about theology. Neither one of us had gone to seminary you know, we came up in youth groups. I was an art major. Mike was a theater and drama major. I was studying to be an architect, actually. And but we got involved in youth ministry. And somehow God used us to get this thing going. And it was, you know, there's some people who, you know, because youth ministry's changed so much over the years, they look back on those early days and, like, say, it's kind of an embarrassment, some of the things that we did back then. But I don't apologize for any of that. I just think it was what was appropriate at that time. And it helped give birth to a lot of other things, and God used it in a very special way. And of course, Youth Specialties has continued to change and grow, and that's good. So it's not the same organization.
Yeah.
Some good, some bad. And there's plenty of other resources and ministries out there that are doing a great job too.
Yeah.
Including you guys.
Oh, well, thanks. And now let me, because I do want to talk further about some of the changes that have morphed in you in terms of how you've thought about ministry, which I think are significant and valuable to all of us. I really believe, you know, when you say 50 years, there's wisdom that comes out of that. So I want to talk about that. But before we do that, I want to ask about this parallel, this other life of yours that, you know, that which to me was a secret for a long time. Till our mutual friends like Marv Penner and Duffy Robbins and Rich Van Pelt and Chap Clark, they start peeling back the curtain, and they're telling me about that there's this other life for this guy who I've seen at Youth Specialties conventions stand on the stage and lead worship with a banjo. That banjo is much more significant in his life than just leading worship. So just a couple of minutes on that, because I have found this fascinating, this other part of Wayne Rice, one of the other parts of Wayne Rice.
It sounds like it's a completely different life, but it's not really. You know, back in the 60s, in youth ministry, one of the ways that we tried to reach kids was through folk music. And so we all ran out and got guitars and banjos and things, tried to put together folk groups. Well, just as it turned out, I discovered I had some talent, you know, particularly with the banjo, which I just loved the sound of it. And my brothers also took up instruments, guitar and mandolin and so on. So we formed a band back in the 60s. First, it was called the Rice Krispies because it was the Rice Brothers. But later, that group kind of morphed into a band called Brush Arbor. And at first, we called that group the Country Church. You know, we thought, well, we play kind of country, gospel, folk, whatever, bluegrass. But we thought, no, you know, we want this to go out. We want to take this out to the world, and the Country Church would turn off, you know, sounds too religious. So Brush Arbor was kind of a mystery name. But Brush Arbor is a country church. You can go look it up. But we got lucky. We got signed by Capitol Records. And the next thing we know, we were playing at the Grand Ole Opry and touring all over the country with country music stars like Johnny Cash and Waylon Jennings and Marty Robbins, and played the old Hee Haw television show and did a whole bunch of stuff. It was a lot of fun. So we did two albums for Capitol. In 1973, we won Vocal Group of the Year in Country Music. So then I had to decide whether to stay in youth work or be a professional musician. So I decided to give up the music side of things and stay in youth work.
But you've continued on, and I mean, you're still involved in a bluegrass community. And you've produced.
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm. What's the show that you produce, or you had been producing?
Yeah, the International Bluegrass Music Association has its annual awards show every year. Used to be in Nashville, now it's Raleigh, North Carolina, which is a real hotbed of bluegrass music there. Last year, 160,000 people came to the bluegrass weekend that we do there. But for 7 years, I produced the awards show. And I still have a radio show that I do in San Diego called the Bluegrass Special. So, yeah, it's a little passion of mine. I love bluegrass music, and I still got my banjo. In fact, it's right behind me. So I pick it up and play almost every day.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we're going to include some we didn't ask your permission for this. Doesn't matter. It's on YouTube, so we can do it. We're going to put some YouTube videos up with this podcast, which are great. I love watching these things. And folks can see a little bit from Brush Arbor. I think there's one from when you were on a Johnny Cash special one point that's out there, and some others as well. So we'll let folks see that side of Wayne. And we're going to take a break now. You want to say something?
No, you'll see that I had hair one time on top of my head.
yeah. But you're recognizable. You're recognizable. It's not a difficult thing. So we'll put those up. Now, listen, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we want to talk to you a little bit about your shift in understanding of ministry and a movement towards family ministry and now what you're doing with grandparents. So we're talking to Wayne Rice, and we'll be back after this break. In an effort to help you help the kids you know and love navigate their emerging sexuality to the glory of God, we've launched a sexual integrity initiative here at CPYU. Thanks to a generous grant from a company called DAS, you can access our sexual integrity initiative and a growing number of resources for free by visiting the website at sexualintegrityinitiative.com. Well, welcome back, everybody, to Youth Culture Matters. We're having a great conversation with our friend Wayne Rice, one of the co-founders of Youth Specialties, and he's got his hands in a lot of other things right now that we're going to hear about in just a little bit. But before we do that, Wayne, we do a thing called Take Five, where either Jason or I will fire five questions. I have no clue what they are. Jason has them right now for you, but you need to answer. This is a way for us to get to know you and people who are listening to hear a little bit about you, so I take no responsibility for anything that Jason may ask. Jason.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like how you always preface,
hey, because
preface my questions.
Well, that's because Wayne's my friend, and I don't want him getting mad at me because of what you asked him.
Okay.
Well, Walt, just so you know, Walt asked me to ask each of these questions, so you can blame him. No, I'm only joking, okay. Kind of. So, okay, here we have joking, five questions. The first one is, what is one thing that you do? And I know that we already talked about the banjo, but what is one thing you do that people who know you might be surprised by? So something beyond the banjo. I know that that was a surprise to Walt, but what is one thing you do that might surprise people that have known you for a little while?
Gosh, most people who know me pretty much know everything that I do. Let's see. I am a avid reader and rereader of Henry Nouwen. So that may not be something that everybody knows. A few people do, but Henry's a constant inspiration to me.
And that's
Dallas, that's great. Do you have a favorite Nouwen book that you go to that you're like, oh, if I have,
probably,
have to choose one?
Yeah, probably The Life of the Beloved. If not The Return of the Prodigal, but so.
All his books are so good.
Yeah. But Henry constantly gets me recentered.
Well, this next question might not apply, but we'll try it anyways. If you had to choose only one sports team to cheer on, only one, out of any sport, out of any they could even not exist anymore, but if you only had to choose one sports team that you could cheer on for the rest of your life, who would it be?
Oh, no. Because that would have been the ex-San Diego Chargers.
I knew it, Jason. I knew you'd open that wound.
Yeah.
But when you start asking that question,
but
I knew it.
I prefaced it by saying it can be a team that no longer exists.
That
so
even,
the
that
San
even
Diego Chargers
deep, that scratched
that.
Deeper.
Well, yeah. And I let me say it would probably be the San Diego Chargers when Dan Fouts was the quarterback, Kellen Winslow was the tight end, John Jefferson was the Chuck Muncy.
Oh yeah.
Great team in the late 70s or 80s. So that team. I'll see him in heaven someday. I'll be cheering.
That's great. San Diego Chargers it is. All right. Okay, so here's a question that Walt and I pass around to our friends. And so since you've known Walt for some time, I'm curious, which celebrity does Walt look like?
Oh, here we go.
Oh, man. A celebrity that Walt.
This so if you need to, our listeners don't know this, but you can see Walt. So drink it in, like take a good look at that face. And tell me, what celebrity might he most look like?
Okay, Mr. Magoo.
Oh! I am. Podcast over. You know, you would pick a co-founder of Youth Specialties to ask that question to.
Hey.
There's nothing reverent that's going to come out of that. You just know you really set me up on that one.
He was the perfect person.
Move on to the next question now, please.
Okay, so I'm going from a little bit of the joking to more of a
I think he was
big
serious.
Question, but who shaped you and your faith the most?
Who shaped me the most in my own faith would probably gosh,
Mr. Magoo.
I look back and at my parents, you know, who were very instrumental in that. I grew up in a Christian home, and my mom and dad were just exemplary parents in the sense that they taught us all about Jesus, and even though you know, I think even growing up in that kind of a home, you have time, you know, a kind of a pulling away from that as a teenager. Or, I mean, it wasn't until I kind of got back into Youth for Christ, I think, that I really owned it for myself. But I look back and I'm really grateful for my parents. And after that, I would say, you know, one person that's had a big influence on me over the years, because I've known him for at least 40 years, is Tony Campolo. And Tony's a dear friend. And first met him about 1975, I think it was. And we've had lots and lots of conversations, had a chance to travel with him. And I look back, there's hardly a day goes by that I don't think of kind of like, what would Tony say about this? Or, but there, so Tony's been a good, a big influence. I think in over the last 20 years, like I say, Henry Nouwen, Dallas Willard, they're probably the most important spiritual influences in my life.
I often say Tony was the one when I was in college who came and spoke at the Jubilee Conference several times about the kingdom of God. This was in the, you know, late 70s. And I learned so much about the kingdom of God and became passionate about that, I hope, or my passion increased, I should say, through his passion on that subject. So, yeah.
Wow. It's great having friends like that. I just have to say that when you have individuals that are in your life that can speak those sort of truths and can also just be a voice in your head, it's a gift. So that's really cool. One more question, and you know, we have a legend on the podcast with you being here. I thought, man, I cannot have you get off this podcast without asking, what are three books every youth pastor should have on their shelves?
That's a good question.
And I'm okay if you go to four or five, or just only say two. So you don't have to just give three only. I understand that this can be a difficult question, especially someone that reads.
Yeah, that's I'd have to probably, if I walked over to my bookcase, you know, I could do this, answer this a little better, because I. But, you know, I just mentioned Dallas Willard and Henry Nouwen. I think Life of the Beloved is got to be right up there, because it's really about ministry in so many ways. It's about who are we as people who are involved in ministry. The Divine Conspiracy, you know, Dallas Willard's work. I know that can sometimes get a little dense, you know, for some youth workers who aren't used to reading someone like Dallas, but it's worth the effort. And he's written a lot of others as well, but I reread and reread Dallas. In youth ministry, gosh, some of the books that I think are significant and still significant.
Hot Talks.
No.
That always comes up when I'm with Duffy. We joke about that all the time. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt your train of thought there. I couldn't resist.
No, and gosh, some of the books that I can't always remember the titles. One of the problems with getting older is you your memory kind of goes, but you know, books like Patricia Hirsch's A Tribe Apart.
Oh yeah.
You know, Mark DeVries's Family-Based Youth Ministry, I think was a groundbreaking work when it came out. So those are some that just come to mind.
That's great.
Good. Thanks for doing that.
Dallas will. Yeah, that's incredible. That's such a great list. And man, Dallas Willard's book rocked my world when I was much younger. And I come back and I read that often. Divine Conspiracy. If you've not read it, our listeners, if you've not read it, please do. It's a phenomenal book. I'm so glad that you mentioned
it. Well, here's a challenge I want to issue, because Wayne just said, you know, man, that's one of the challenges of getting older. You don't remember titles. But one of the beauties of getting older is the accumulated wisdom. So for those youth workers who are younger to be able to tap into this, when someone like Wayne makes a recommendation about a book, get the book and read the book. There's a reason why the recommendation is made, and so do that. So good. Thanks for doing that, Wayne, being a good sport. Hey, talking about books, all right, so let's shift here. I want to talk about a book that you wrote that came out in 2010, published by InterVarsity Press, titled Reinventing Youth Ministry Again, and the subtitle is From Bells and Whistles to Flesh and Blood. And it's very autobiographical, just about your own journey. Talk a little bit about why you wrote this and what the message was you were trying to get across.
Well, the reason for writing it, is several people kind of asked me to write a little bit, like a memoir, you know, just of some of the early days of Youth Specialties and how we got started and all of that. And I really didn't feel like I wanted to do, you know, who would read that, you know, but I thought, well, maybe I could kind of incorporate some of that into a book that kind of shows how I've progressed, you know, in terms of what I think about youth work and where I was speaking somewhere and somebody introduced me as one of the, you know, inventors of youth ministry. And it was embarrassing for one thing, but I thought, you know, I didn't invent youth ministry, but if I had invented youth ministry, would I be proud of that? You know, it just got me thinking about, you know, I didn't invent it, but some people say youth specialties helped kind of reinvent it. Well, what if we were to do it all over again, if we were to start YS today, how would it be different? You know, so I kind of took that as a jumping off place. What would youth ministry look like today if we were creating it from scratch, you know, just sort of coming up with the new idea books, you know, and assuming that there wasn't a lot out there. So that's kind of what got me into writing that book, was I just wanted to say, this is how we used to think. This is how I think it is today, and what we would do differently. And so a lot of that, of course, has to do with the way we view adolescence, the way we view the family as part of what we're doing, the way we view the church. You know, for example, when we started youth ministry, one of our goals was to provide a program for the kids that was not part of the church. So we started setting up youth groups, we kind of brought the parachurch model into the church so that the kids would kind of have a program of their own. And so they had their own ways of doing things. And in some cases, you know, the youth groups had their, besides their own social events and camps and conferences and Sunday school classes and so on, they even had their own worship services. And so we really began a process of separating kids from the rest of the church back in the 60s and 70s. And that really, I think, when you look around then in the 80s and 90s and today, you know, you see that that's pretty common, that a lot of youth ministries are basically programs that are pretty autonomous apart from the church body. So I think if we were starting youth ministry all over again, we would do it differently and find a way to work with students in the context of the whole church, not separate from it. And that's just one of the number of things that I talk about in that book. It's what led me to eventually take a job at a church. I decided to stop just talking about it and actually try to do it. is I went into a church that was really age segregated and had been for years, and try to change the culture of that church to an intergenerational church. I didn't try to do it by myself. The senior pastor, the executive pastor, the board of elders, they all were in agreement that that's what they wanted to see happen, and they asked me to come on and make it happen. And so for 6 years, I was pastor to generations at College Avenue Baptist, and that's still an ongoing project, but it's very difficult to reverse that model of age segregated church, the silos. So
yeah, with a long view, you get to see the downside of that, the things we did for years in youth ministry, and now you're issuing, is it fair to say, a corrective, a paradigm shift?
Yeah, and I, you know, I think that's just one of the mistakes, though. I don't think we ever really intended for that to happen.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of what naturally did happen. The better we got at youth ministry, the more professional. You know, when we started Youth Specialties, our goal was we wanted youth workers to feel like they were professionals, you know, that just like pastors are professionals, you know, youth workers were not treated with respect. And so we wanted youth workers to feel respected. And so that's why the Youth Workers Convention, we started writing books for youth workers and so on. But I think what happened, the natural progression then, was that a lot of parents and older people, for example, when I grew up, my church was very intergenerational. And just the older folks in the church, you know, the parents, the grandparents, they were running the youth programs. But as soon as we professionalized youth ministry, they stopped doing it. And they said, let's hire a professional. And so that changed what was going on in thousands of churches all over the country. So the parents and the grandparents, the adult community of the church, they no longer got involved in passing faith on to the next generation. They hired somebody to do it. And that's, you know, while there's positives there, because in some ways a lot of young people really needed somebody who was completely dedicated and properly trained, you know, to come alongside them. At the same time, I think it really robbed a lot of very capable adults in the church of their ability to be influencers of the generations coming up behind them. And so what we're trying to do in our church is connect all of our kids with, you know, we're doing that where, you know, every kid in the church has at least six adults. Yeah. Who are, it's kind of reversing, flipping that old six to one ratio, or one adult to, and doing that, we do nothing but blended adults, kids together, for just about everything in our church.
That's awesome.
One of the things people probably don't know, you know, you asked me about, Jason, is, you know, I lead a mission trip every year to Mexico. That's an intergenerational kids and adults together, parents and kids. No longer do we do youth mission trips. They're intergenerational family, so they can go and serve together and have that as a shared experience rather than all the kids coming back all fired up, but the adults have no idea what took place. So I moved from youth ministry, doing it the way we did it back in the 70s and 80s, to working with parents. And a lot of that was because we discovered that no matter how great youth workers were, how professional they became, they still never could outweigh the influence of parents spiritually on a kid. And that's not just somebody making a a wild claim there. That's what the research shows, and that's what all the research has shown. And so I spent 20 years doing seminars for parents just to help parents connect with their kids in a meaningful, positive way, and then doing the intergenerational thing. But while I was doing that, I also did a class for the grandparents of our church to help them connect with their grandkids who were, I mean, a lot of the grandparents had no idea how to do that. And it was really well attended. And I couldn't find any resources, you know, to help me do this. So I had to kind of write my own curriculum, you know, on this, in this grandparenting class.
Grandparent ideas. That's what, you're all over again. Yeah.
So, but what I discovered was here's all these grandparents who would love to leverage the love and influence that they have on their grandkids. They just didn't know how to do it. And so we did it was a 6-week class at our church, and it was an eye opener. So I started looking around for some more ideas on grandparenting, and it's kind of led to what I'm doing now.
Yeah. Talk about the Legacy Coalition, because we want to connect people with that, because for the youth workers who are listening, you know, we've encouraged you to resource parents. We want to encourage you to resource grandparents. And what you're doing with the Legacy Coalition is clearly growing into something that is a good resource for youth workers to tap into, to pass on to grandparents, and then even the parents who are listening to help their own parents, grandparent better with their kids. I mean, the culture is so strong and convincing and compelling in the messages that we need more people speaking truth into the lives of kids, you know, the flesh and blood people who God has given them, moms, dads, and grandmas and grandpas. So I want to hear about this. This is exciting.
No, thanks, Walt. You know, we talked about Dallas Willard a little while ago, and he is one of my, you know, he's no longer with us, of course. He passed away a few years ago, but he continues to speak through his books and writings and videos and so on. I saw John Ortberg do an interview with Dallas, and I think you can get the video. But I think it's called The Divine Conspiracy. There's a video series. But John asks Dallas Willard who had the biggest influence on him when he was growing up. It's the question you asked me. Dallas, without flinching, I mean, he just said it was his grandmother. And he started talking about his grandmother. And he said, you know, my grandmother probably never thought of herself as a saint, you know, but she was a saint. And she lived the life that I think we all aspire to want to live. She was a good woman. And listening to that, it really shook me. I was thinking, you know, I'm a grandpa. I've got 5 grandkids, you know, and do my grandkids, will they be able to say that about me someday? You know, I know I've you know, blown it in many ways with my own kids, but we've got these grandkids coming up, and they are so precious to us, and they look up to us as almost godlike in some way. And in fact, what I've been discovering is that sometimes I think for grandkids, their grandparents, they listen to even more than they listen to their parents. They feel safer, and they feel even, you know, and the parents are often involved in all kinds of baggage, getting their kid, you know, they want their kids to do well in school and get the good grades and get into a good college. Grandparents, the only thing we care about our grandkids is that they be good people and that they come to love Jesus. And I think there's a lot of grandparents out there who want to know how to do that, but they don't. Deuteronomy 4:9 says, teach these things to your children and to your children's children. And I think a lot of parents think that they're done once they've taught it to their children. But the scripture clearly commands grandparents to think to a third generation and maybe to a fourth or fifth. And So a couple of years ago, I met up with a guy's name is Larry Fowler. Larry is an Awana. He's been a lifer in Awana. And I used to always kind of make jokes about Awana, you know, and the little uniforms and all that kind of stuff. But we had an Awana group at our church at College Avenue, and I really admired a lot of those people for what they were doing with those kids as they were studying scripture and so forth. But somebody said, you know, you need to talk to Larry Fowler. He's trying to get something going to help minister to grandparents. And so I contacted him, and we had lunch. And out of that, we started this new ministry called the Legacy Coalition. And Larry was saying, you know, that there are thousands of books on parenting, you know, Christian books on parenting, but he could only find a total of books ever published on grandparenting. He could find 8, and about 4 of those were out of print. And so it was one of the reasons why I couldn't find any resources on grandparenting. So we thought, well, why don't we start something? Why don't we start a new ministry to help provide encouragement and motivation and tools for grandparents to really be intentional Christian grandparents, be more intentional about passing on faith to their grandkids. And Larry says, you know, to my knowledge, there's never been a national conference on grandparenting. And I'd like to see if we couldn't do one. And I thought, well, I have had some experience putting on national conferences, so why don't we do one? So you know, we're all older people, and so we thought, well, let's not wait for, you know, 5 years from now to do this. Let's do it now. Let's do it this year. So in 2016, which was a little over a year after we actually formed the organization, we did the first national conference on grandparenting. And I called up some of my old friends. And so we had speakers right away that were signed on. Everybody thought it was a great idea. So we had Chuck Swindoll and Josh McDowell and John Trent, Gary Chapman, you know, Tim and Darcy Kimmel, lots of great people. Michelle Anthony, you know, Michelle, even though she's not a grandparent, she's very much involved in generational discipleship, which is really what this is all about. And so I called up some of my old James Ward and you know, a lot of people that used to do the YS convention back in the day. And we put on a conference, the Legacy Grandparenting Summit, that took place in November at Stonebriar. Chuck Swindoll and he brought his kids and his grandkids, and they did a whole general session. It was powerful stuff. And so we're planning the second now. Last year we called it the first ever national conference on Christian grandparenting. So we can't use that anymore. So there's been one. So we're doing a second one. But this is so much fun, and I'm learning as I go. And in fact, all of us are. You know, this has never been done before. We've actually published a couple of books already on Christian grandparenting. And it's been very energizing and exciting to me. It's just like starting new specialties back in 1968. Mm. It's seeing a need that needs to be filled, and just doing it, and letting God lead you step by step. And we've really felt the hand of God in this. It's just it's really kind of miraculous how it all came together, it's very exciting. So that's what I'm doing right
now. This is awesome. And Wayne, I just think it's neat to see, you know, for the guys and the gals who are younger in youth ministry, maybe just starting out, just how God takes you on a journey and the kinds of things that God puts in your path, the opportunities that are there, how to respond to needs. So we appreciate you. I appreciate what you did for me when I was in my own school years, and then as a youth pastor, and what you did for all our volunteers and our students, and what you continue to do now as a granddad. I'm excited about that, to hear more about this. So we're going to include links to everything. I'm on the site right now, legacycoalition.com. I was scrolling down. I'll just read this. I love in big letters, the gap between what is and what ought to be is enormous. And the fact that you're filling that gap, you've done it for youth workers, now you're doing it for grandparents, it's so admirable, and we're grateful for you and what you do. So we're happy you're on here. Did you want to say something else?
Can I say just one other thing, Walt, is, you know, God called me into youth ministry when I was in college. I mean, I was studying to be an architect, but the Lord put on my heart a love for kids, a love for teenagers. And he said, Wayne, this is what I want you to do for the rest of your life. And a lot of people think, well, I'm not working with kids anymore. You know, it's the same call.
Yeah.
I still feel called to youth ministry. That's why I'm working with grandparents. Grandparents are key to this whole thing. And so it's just that I'm older now, and I can relate a lot better to grandparents than I can to kids. But God puts a call on your life, and he puts you in different, you know, he gives you a vocation, then he gives you an occupation along the way that allows you to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And the occupation often changes.
Yeah.
But the calling and to serve him, it just, that never changes.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for that. That's so encouraging. Well, this has been good, huh, Jason? Fun to talk to Wayne.
I love this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're going to, as we said before, everything we've talked about, and I think even more, we'll put up as links on the page. This is going to be a long one, guys. You got a lot to put up there because we've had lots of good discussion about lots of things. And we definitely want people, if they're just going to look at one or two of the things that we've talked about here today, go to legacycoalition.com. Check that out. Stay in touch with what's happening with the conference that'll be coming up this year later. And Wayne, thank you. Thank you for your ministry and your willingness to spend a little time with us today. We will be back again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters, and we look forward to chatting with you then.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.